This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I have really a great pleasure in speaking with Jim Cott. He's the author of a new book called If These Walls Could Talk, New York Yankees Stories from the Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. It's a really great book with a lot of wonderful stories about baseball broadcasting, just a tremendously rich collection of stories. For those of you who might not know, Jim Cott was a major league pitcher for 25 years, and when after he retired, became a broadcaster and went on to broadcast baseball for over 30 years, still doing it now with MLB Network. It's a beautiful spring day, and I'm looking forward to talking to Jim about baseball and broadcasting. Jim's in Vermont. I hope he's enjoying the day. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing fine, doing great. It is a beautiful spring day. I hope it's the same in New York.
It is actually pretty good around New York right now, and better weather than we've been having, so we're happy about that. This book is really, I know, very much about the Yankees, and it's full of anecdotes that only someone who's been around the Yankees could probably tell, and that's very special. But I hope you don't mind. I want to ask you some questions about, first, about your career as a player and maybe some general baseball questions before we talk about the Yankees.
Sure, that's fine.
So you started, you were in the minor leagues in the late 50s. You grew up in Michigan, and you started out playing with they were the Washington Senators, but soon to become the Minnesota Twins. And you're well known for a lot of different things in baseball, not the least of which is your fielding 16 gold gloves. But I want to ask you a little bit about the World Series. Your first World Series is 1965, and you pitched in it. But you've been around a lot of work. And then you were also in the 1982 World Series for the Cardinals. But as a broadcaster also, you've been around a lot of World Series. And I guess, I just want to ask you from your perspective as a player and around other players, for people in the fans, in the seats, the fans were all like really excited about it. But are the players as hopped up about the World Series as we are as fans?
Oh, I think definitely. I think any player, when you're a young player, your goals are a little more selfish. You want to get to the big leagues. You want to be successful. You want to stay around for a while. But the ultimate goal is to be on a World Series team and a World Series winner. So I think we actually got more hyped up about it in the pre-playoff days. I was in the World Series for the first time in '65. And there were no playoffs then. Then I went back in '82 with the Cardinals. There was one layer of playoffs, but now with the wild cards and the playoffs, several layers. It's still very exciting to a player, but I think from a fan standpoint, the excitement and the pressure is probably greater in the playoffs nowadays than it is in the World Series.
So, do you feel? I mean, it is sort of funny that you brought that up because I did want to, you've been around the game so long and you've seen so many different eras of baseball and the changes that have happened over the last 50, 60 years. You're probably one of the few people who has been around so much of the game that you can answer, you can think about it in this historical way. From a player's perspective, do you think the playoffs, as you just said, now have these rounds and rounds of playoffs and teams getting into the playoffs that never would have had a chance in the old way of doing it. Do players feel good about that, or do they even, do they know what it was like in the past? They don't really have a point of reference to compare it to.
No, they really don't. I mean, and that's just the culture, I think, of today's probably young people, athletes, all walks of life. There are still some who are very interested in the history of baseball. I was very fortunate that my dad was such a baseball fan that, I started following baseball when I was 7 years old, and I can still recall my first World Series, Cubs and Tigers, in 1945 when I was 6 years old. But now I walk in a clubhouse with today's players, and I would say the majority of them, other than if they see me on TV, they don't even realize that I played. So, you know, and with the money that's available to players, and I don't say this in a negative standpoint, it's just the culture today. They don't care what we did, how we did it, whether we won the World Series or not. All they know is, you know, if they hit 20 home runs and have a good year, they're going to make several million dollars, and they hope their team goes to the World Series. So I think there's a lot different attitude today. It's just natural, I think, with the world we live in. Everybody wants things to happen faster, and they want them to happen their way.
Well, you know, one of the things I've thought about for a really long time about baseball, and maybe all the other sports as well, is thinking about what it was like when I was growing up, and probably when you were growing up. It was possible, you know, players who played on major league teams still lived in their communities. They still had to have jobs because baseball didn't pay the huge amount of money that it does today. So there was this feeling, I think, different then, that the distance between the players and the fans had to have been less. You know, you were part of a community. We could actually meet major league players who lived near us, or you know, walking down the street. It wouldn't be that strange, and we wouldn't have. I mean, we still would have treated them as special because they were our heroes. But you know, I know people who grew up in places where they got to play ball with, you know, Del Crandall and people like that, you know, just because those guys lived in their towns. And today, you know, the players are much more distant from the regular everyday life of the fans once they reach that level, you know, and they start earning that kind of money. There's just this kind of social distance that occurs. And I wondered if you, what you thought about that idea, and, you know, whether that feels different to you around the game.
Oh, it definitely does. I think you mentioned in there the word social, and I think social media, you know, there's just a lot more electronic communication these days. Like you mentioned, we in the 60s in Minnesota, I had a job in the off season, and you know, even during the season where we parked our cars, it was not strange to walk out of the stadium sometimes with fans that were still making their way to their cars, or they'd be hanging around the parking lot. We talk baseball with them, whereas now, for security reasons, you know, there's very much you know, interaction like that with today's players. And, you know, the majority of it is the reason of security, but that's definitely different. The same way with the media, you know, sports writers, they traveled with us. We played bridge with them. We went to the racetrack with them. You know, there was a much more of a bond between the writers that followed us and the players. They trusted the players. We trusted them. You know, things that happened in the clubhouse stayed in the clubhouse, where that doesn't exist today. And unfortunately, because, you know, a lot of the writers that followed my teams going back to Minnesota, Chicago, and Philadelphia, they, you know, they became good friends.
And so do you feel like today that even for you as a former player, and obviously former players have a certain level of greater respect from current players, I would assume, than just the average, you know, because you played, you at least, you know what the experience of being on the diamond is like. But are you saying that, you know, there's less opportunity for you to be friendly with current players?
Oh yeah, there's much less. There are, you know, I happen to cover Boston quite a few games, the Yankees. So as I go into those cities year after year and I see the same players, I develop a good relationship, and I followed the Yankees for years on, you know, doing their games on the cable network. But there's a lot of clubhouse. For example, recently I did a Cubs game, and I walked into the clubhouse. I know the manager and the coaches, but I would say the majority of the players in there had no idea who I was, and I had no idea who they were. I mean, I knew their names, but it's the first time I'd seen them. So
right.
It's much more distant than it used to be.
And would it be truer in the past? I don't want to dwell on this too much longer, but just curious. Like, let's say a player from the 60s, you know, somebody walks in who played in baseball as long as you did. Well, and of course, in your time, you set the record for the longest number of years pitched before Nolan Ryan and Tommy John. But let's supposing, you know, somebody walked into your clubhouse when you were a young player who had been in baseball in the 40s, do you feel like the respect for them as a player would have been greater than it is today if you walk into a clubhouse?
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, first of all, I think I would have known, like when we first played an exhibition game against the Braves, I couldn't wait to meet Warren Spahn, and I got a chance to meet him, and he spent some time with me as a pitcher, you know, going down to the bullpen. That kind of stuff just doesn't happen today, or at least it doesn't happen in my career. No. Whereas if I saw, you know, first of all, I may not recognize all of them out of uniform, but if somebody walked in the clubhouse and they said, "Hey, there's so and so," I mean, I would certainly know who it was and would go out of my way to meet them, and I probably knew a lot of details of their career. And that's just different today. They're not into as much of the history. There are exceptions, but very few.
Well, now we can turn to some of the Yankees that you talked about in the book. The obvious person to ask about, I'm sure everybody wants to talk about Jeter, but it seems like Jeter would have been one of those people that understood the history of the game and really cared about it. Is that true?
Well, you know, I don't know if he would, and that is not a negative comment about Derek, and I'll tell you why. There's a story about where Alex Rodriguez was looking for a place to get his hair cut or his hair styled, and Derek mentioned to him, "Well, I have a fellow that comes to my apartment, and he's coming after the game tonight, so why don't you come home with me, and he can cut your hair." So they got to Derek's apartment, and while Derek was getting his hair cut, Alex was fiddling with the TV, and he said, "Well, where's the MLB channel and the all the baseball highlights and the baseball package?" And Derek said, "I don't watch that stuff." I said, I just play baseball. I don't watch the games. I don't pay attention to the other games. I just play for the Yankees." So, you know, that's not a bad thing. I mean, he just was not wrapped up in what other teams or other players were doing. He was just, you know, concentrating on being who he was for the Yankees. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing. You know, I think it puts a lot less pressure on a player than those who try to pay attention to every word that's said about them.
Well, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
Well,
I think Derek, just to backtrack a minute, certainly Derek had his heroes because, you know, one of the reasons he wanted to play for the Yankees is, as a kid, Dave Winfield was one of his favorite players. So certainly he followed the game as a youngster and would know who Dave Winfield was and probably some of the stars in the past. But I don't think he followed it like I did. And one of the reasons is that when I was a kid, baseball was kind of the only game in town. Professional sports in other sports was not as attractive, didn't get the exposure. There wasn't cable TV. So just following those box scores and listening to the games on the radio every day during the summer, you know, baseball had a captive audience. So that's what those of us from my era followed, whereas today, guys are, you know, they're into fantasy football pools and they're following all the other sports that we never did.
No, that's a good point. And I think, you know, in the earlier times, baseball was the dominant sport and every kid growing up wanted to be a baseball player, or at least we thought that anyway. But today you've got multiple sports to aspire to and, you know, who knows? You know, maybe I sort of lived in baseball history when I was a kid. You know, I could probably still tell you the number of hits that Babe Ruth had in 1932 if I had to. But, but you know, you got to work with some of my heroes of broadcasting. You know, at the number of tremendous people that you, and not only ex-players like Kenny Singleton, who I've been listening to for years and I think is really phenomenal, But you had Bobby Mercer, Tony Kubek, Tim McCarver, Paul O'Neill, David Cohn, Al Leiter, Flaherty. I mean, you've been with an awful lot of tremendous people. And one of the things you mentioned in the book was learning how to become a broadcaster. And I found your storytelling about that was really interesting to me. You worked, it seems to me, I don't mean to just, you know, tell you you're great, but you worked as hard at learning how to be a broadcaster as you did learning how to be a baseball player.
Well, I really did. I mean, there are some, and I went over this with Mike Schmidt, who was, you know, Hall of Famer, voted the best Philly of the century and all those kind of awards. But I remember telling Mike, if you want to make it in this business, those kind of things aren't going to carry you in the booth. You have to work on it, at it, like you did as a player. And of course, I had good advice from my friend Timmy McCarver, the way he worked at it, and that's the reason he became as great as and as accepted as he has been, is because he worked at it. From an announcer standpoint, Dick Enberg and Dick Stockton and Greg Gumbel and John Madden and guys like that, I picked their brains. So I tried to learn the fundamentals of the broadcast part of it, as well as pay attention to, you know, the baseball, which I knew what was going on the field. But, you know, there's a certain amount of homework that you need to mine from players and managers and coaches. And so, yes, I tried to put the same amount of effort into that.
Well, and it does seem that, you know, former players have an immediate advantage on one level, and that is, you know, the game intimately. You know what it's like to be out on the field. You know what the lives of the players are like. And you also, and you mentioned this, I think, that as a pitcher, you know, when it comes time to figuring out what pitch was just thrown, I mean, you do have a huge advantage because you've seen so many pitches in your life. So even if the booth is not really ideal for your sight line, you are able to interpolate maybe better than the average person would do, whether that was a fastball, a cutter, or, you know, a splitter or whatever. But even with that kind of advantage, it still requires a certain amount of attention to what the listener would find most enjoyable. That's the part that I thought was really interesting to hear you talk about, you know, the kind of flow of the game and the way that you set up announcing the game through the course of the nine innings or more, you know, saying things differently the first three innings, then differently again in the middle, and then differently again at the end. I thought that was really, you know, it was kind of inside broadcasting, the way sometimes you see inside baseball books, you know, kind of giving you the true story of what it's like to be a player. I think you gave a lot of really good information about what it's like to be an announcer.
Well, I appreciate that. I as I said, had advice and picked the brain of Dick Enberg. Then there was the late Harry Coyle and Gene Kirby and guys that were not former players, that were in there as professional broadcasters, directors, and producers. It became pretty apparent that there's a particular pattern when you do a game on TV. There's housekeeping things you pay attention to in the early part of the game, in terms of lineups. And, you know, you have to assume that on the national basis, not everybody knows who's the manager of this team or that team. So you kind of put a face with the name of the early innings, and then you get an idea of how the game is going, and then that dictates whether it's going to be a blowout and you're going to tell a lot of stories. And people, I'm sure, are, if you want to keep the audience with you, you have to have some entertaining stories for them. And then the end of the game, if it's close, you get into what the managers are thinking and who's on the bench and who's in the bullpen. Now, today, it's changed so much because baseball on television has gone from, I think, a play-by-play, a professional play-by-play announcer's game. They were the focal point. And then along came Tony Kubek and then Timmy McCarver, who I think really changed the game more than any former players to how we look at the game and giving fans insight. Then it became an analyst game. So the networks would say to the producers and directors, follow the analyst. Whatever he was talking about, follow him. Well, now it became a producer's game because there's so many more elements, so many more bells and whistles. So it's more difficult today to actually talk inside baseball than it was when I first started. And then you add to the producer's element, now it's the salespeople, because every item now, if you mention a replay or a lineup, it always has a company name attached to it, and you usually have to give them a little plug or slogan that they've paid for. So it's you don't get to talk as much baseball as you did in the early days.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, I think as a listener, we certainly have noticed the number of plugs that are made. And of course, it's all, you know, interrelated. That, you know, games are popular. They got to pay for the, they have to pay for it. So,
sure.
You know, and the,
cash is king.
Yeah. I mean, the teams are getting paid more, the players are getting paid more. So we have to, as viewers, we have to listen to more ads. It kind of, you know, that's the freight that we pay to enjoy the game.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know, so I wanted to ask you about that. This is another kind of broadcast question in a certain way, but it's also related to the game. You mentioned one of the great stories in this book, I thought, was that when you talked about Jeter's home run in the 1996 ALCS, and I kind of had forgotten about that. I don't know why, but and this is the home run that was disputed. Probably and was definitively touched by a fan and probably should have been not a home run, but it was a home run, and that's the way it used to be. And I wanted to ask you about replays, and not just whether you think replays are a good idea, but how they've now, what does it do to alter the flow of the game? You know, in this, we have replays where the umpires are going to wait for somebody in New York to review a play. So everybody's standing around now. And I like replays on a certain level because they get it right more. But, and I guess I just want to know, since you've been a player, now you've also been a broadcaster for all these years, you've seen so many games. What do you think about the replay?
Well, I think it's good. I say that hesitantly. I think it'll get better. I think that with electronics, with technology, they should be able to determine the outcome of those plays quicker and quicker. I think it's a lot like football. At first, when replay came onto football, I think, oh, you know, how much time is that going to take? I think now viewers have come to expect that they're going to get a replay because they want to get the play right. So I think that's the number one objective right now for the fans, is that let's get the play right. They don't. If you're a Baltimore fan, you didn't want to see that Jeter fly ball, which was interfered with by Jeffrey Mayer. You didn't want to see that call the home run. You wanted to get the call right. So I think fans have accepted that. Players have accepted it, that it might take a minute or so. And I think baseball is constantly working on getting that process to happen faster and faster.
And overall, are the players happier? Managers, coaches, everybody. I mean, people are the actual people on the field liking the fact that the call is more likely to be right this way? And what do the umpires think?
Well, I think for the most part they like. I think the one play, and a friend of mine, Bill Madden, is going to do an article shortly in New York. He talked to me today that I don't think this is such a novel idea, but I mentioned it a while back, and I've gotten several calls on it, that I had said to some people, baseball people, months ago, why don't they just make the call at home plate a force play? That seems to be the most delicate call. Whether a runner interferes with the catcher, whether the catcher has blocked the plate illegally, that's a tough thing for the umpire to interpret. And it could have decided the World Series last year had Alex Gordon been sent home. Who knows what might have happened? And you'd hate to see a World Series decided by a call at home plate where they had to check replay and say, no, that run doesn't count. He bowled over the catcher illegally. So my thought on that play is that they could just make it a force play. So I think that's one play that generally managers and players are they're not happy about. You know, a guy could be out by 10 feet, But if the catcher happens to be standing in the line and tags him, why, technically you could overturn that call, which is not really common sense. So that's the one replay I think they have to refine. But I think most of the others are accepted by players, umpires, and coaches and managers and fans.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I do think that the change in the rule on the play at home has been confounding. I think that they do need to figure out a better way to solve the problem. It's absolutely right. You don't want people getting hurt unnecessarily, but I don't think the current solution really satisfies anybody. Let's see, there's so many things I wanted to ask you about, probably won't have time to ask them all, but, you know, even though this book is about the Yankees and you mentioned some really great players that you got to know and were involved with, including Billy Martin and Gene Michael and Thurman Munson, and, you know, you were around Joe Torre, who, speaking of, you know, players who never got to go to the World Series, I guess he had the record at one point, or maybe he still does, for playing the most number of games as a player and never going to the World Series. But, you know, I wanted to ask you, I guess it's inevitable to ask about Steinbrenner. You know, he's a big part of the Yankees for the last 30 years or so or more, and you had a lot of interaction with him. Overall, you came out respecting him, I think, you know, maybe more so than I would have expected you to do.
Well, it's more so than I expected to do, really, knowing our start. When I was a player, I had quite a controversial issue with George, and that he conveniently forgot what he had promised me contractually. And, you know, I was pretty annoyed about that for a long time. But when it came time for WPIX to hire me to do Yankee games in 1986, they had to get his approval, and he was more than willing to approve me. Then after 1 year, decided he wanted Billy Martin in there, so I didn't get renewed. And then when Tony Kubek recommended me in 1995 for the job with Madison Square Garden Network, he again went out of his way to approve me, and that's when our relationship started, as we then spent a lot more time face-to-face. And he heard me actually announce games for his team. And so then I think he became a lot more respectful of what I had to say about his team and players. And so from there on forward, I think he appreciated the fact that I spoke my mind and stuck to my convictions. And I had credibility with the players and with the baseball community. And I think he respected that. So we ended up having a very nice relationship.
It sounds like he did end up respecting people who maintained their position and their integrity. And if you were right, you were right, which I think is good. And of course, you retired as a Yankee broadcaster, and that was a pretty great story. I think another one of the stories you told in the book that I thought was very emotional for me and probably for a lot of other people was the 9-1-1 2001 story, you know, about what happened with the Yankees in that.
Yeah, that was a pretty special time. It really gave me insight, and I think everybody insight, as to what a baseball team can do, an organization, to kind of help a city heal. I mean, I can still remember Bernie Williams going down. He looked at one of the people there that was looking for a relative, and he just said, you know, look, you look like you need a hug. And it was things like that, guys visiting the firehouses. And I think the players did a great job of realizing that they didn't have to do that, but they knew that they could make an impact, and they took it upon themselves to feel like this was a civic responsibility that we need to use our fame, so to speak, to reach out to these people and show them that we care about them. So it was a bitter time. It was a sad time to be in New York City, but it was also satisfying to see what the Yankees and what the individual players did to help out the community in the best way they could.
Yeah, that was very emotional. I thought that was really a well done piece. So you're now, you still are broadcasting. You're broadcasting for MLB Network?
Yeah, I had retired. My wife was battling cancer and subsequently passed away in 2008. So after the 2006 season, I just decided that I would, retire then. And we spent the next year touring around the country in a motorhome and just spent the whole time together, and which was very worthwhile, obviously. And then, you know, I had no real plans to go back into announcing, but the MLB Network launched in 2009. And, of course, I'm very flattered when I hear a lot of Yankee fans say, oh, I wish you were still doing Yankee games. Well, I reached out to the YES Network and said, I think I'm going to get back into the business on a part-time basis. And since I did Yankee games for so many years, and I had a great relationship with Kendi Singleton, and we had so much fun doing games together, I said, I'd love to come back and do a few series with Kenny. But the answer I got was the roster was full and they had budget concerns, which I kind of chuckled at because I never, I would have worked for a very nominal fee just to do some games again with Kenny. But at least I gave them an opportunity. And then fortunately, I got to hook up with Bob Costas, and it's now our seventh year already. It's hard to believe it's been that long, but it's really worked out for a nice situation for me. I do about 10 or 12 games a year, and they're all what we call showcase games. So most of them are, when two real good teams get matched up, and we have a great crew. And of course, with MLB doing only baseball, I mean, we have so much research and information and different angles that we look at. And now with the bells and whistles and cameras and sabermetrics and everything else you can come up with, I enjoy my job because I'm the one that has to kind of keep looking at the field and saying, wait a minute, this is the way the game is still played, despite all the other things that are there. So I enjoy that part of it.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be able to still listen to you broadcasting. I listened to you for many years and enjoyed you tremendously. So I'm glad you're still working. I wish you were in the Hall of Fame. I think you should be.
But, well, I appreciate that. It's not high on my list of things I worry about, but it's nice to hear. I probably get as much satisfaction out of hearing people go in and out of baseball that constantly will say to me, you should be in the Hall of Fame. Now, if I were in the Hall of Fame, there's probably a segment that would be saying, what's he doing in there? So it's very satisfying and appreciative when I hear people say that. So I appreciate that.
No, no problem. Well, you've done great things, so I think you deserve it. But thanks so much for talking to me. I really appreciate your taking the time when it's a beautiful day and you could be wandering in the woods. So thanks for talking to me.
Well, it's I appreciate the time and I appreciate you mentioning the book and the comments that others will read about it. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've had the great pleasure of talking to Jim Kott about If These Walls Could Talk, his book about the New York Yankees. Thanks so much.